like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before we go any further, my gigantic thanks to Bev Capshaw, who hosted last week's show in my absence. Bev conducted an important and informative conversation with Robin Mazo and Nadia Palomino, the Virgin Cats of Tampa Bay. They discussed their work aiming to cultivate adoptions at Hillsborough County Pet Resource Center by promoting awareness of particular animals available to PRC and through other means. If you missed the show, I strongly recommend listening to it on the WMNF archives. Meanwhile, my guest today, as a distinctive way to observe Earth Day, is Mike Burkhead, longtime producer of wildlife documentaries, who served as co-director, co-producer, and co-writer of Legendary Tigers of India, a new episode of the long-running PBS series Nature, to premiere tonight, April 22nd, Earth Day. This film is singular in multiple respects, including that it profiles India's Ranthambore's National Park, and the rising and falling fortunes of the tigers who've lived there. Protracted decades of hunting had decimated the tiger population there, prompting the remaining animals to become extremely reclusive. But owing to the protection afforded by Prime Minister Indira Gandhi's ban on hunting in the early 1970s, the numbers rebounded, expanding a group of about a dozen tigers into a coterie of 70-plus cats. Legendary Tigers of India delivers this narrative chiefly through the voice of Valmik Tapur, one of the world's leading tiger experts, a prolific writer and filmmaker, who told the compelling story of this tiger dynasty for the first time here before passing away in May of 2025. Among the many tiger films Tapur previously produced or was otherwise involved with was the presenter of Nature's six-part 1998 collaboration with the BBC, India, Land of the Tiger, produced by my guest today, Mike Burkhead. So it all comes together. So we'll likely hear some intriguing tiger history and stories, as well as learning about the late great tiger authority, Valmik Tapur, all guided in this new film by Mike Burkhead. We'll speak with momentarily on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll play a song selected to salute Earth Day. That's today, of course. The song is Mother Nature by Greg Roy, one of the fantastic artists performing at Tropical Heat Wave, WMNF's one-night music festival happening this Saturday, April 25th, at the Cuban Club in Ybor City. The lineup features Cracker, Keller Williams, Elin Jewell, Have Gun Will Travel, and several more bands. We'll hear an Earth Day song from a heatwave artist a bit later on Talking Animals on WMNF. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with Mike Burkhead about Legendary Tigers of India, premiering again tonight on Nature on PBS. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Mike Burkhead to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Mike.
Hi, nice to hear you. Nice to hear you all the way from America. I'm here in sunny England today.
And is it sunny in England right then?
It's beautiful today.
Wow.
Absolutely gorgeous, but very chilly, but bright sunshine, which is most unusual.
Okay, well, I will take that as a good sign. So congratulations on the film. I found it fascinating for sure, but also refreshing too, just kind of literally miles from some of the programming about tigers that we've seen here in the U.S. Tiger King and other assorted shows come to mind. So watching the doc was a joyful experience, largely because discussing just about all things tiger related seemed to make Valmik truly exuberant.
Valmik was a genuine enthusiast like no one else. He was a unique character that really looked after the tigers for 50 years. And that's why we made the film. It was a celebration of his 50 years associated with tigers.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you to sort of describe him in some detail, so it sounds like we've already got a start. So huge enthusiast and a huge protector of the tigers, What else can you tell us about Bellamy?
Yeah, he was a big man in every respect. He took no prisoners. And that's why I liked him, because things were black and white for Valmik. You saved the Tigers, and that's what he was interested in. He wasn't interested in excuses for not saving Tigers. And that's what made him unique, and he could talk to anybody in the country. He could contact the very top, the Prime Minister. He could contact ministers. But he was equally at home in the forest. He was a fearsome character for sure, but his tigery aggression is what helped save the Tigers through two or three major crises over the years.
Yeah, well, we'll get into one or more of those crises for sure. But he really seemed to have an encyclopedic knowledge of Tigers and just, I guess, a boundless enthusiasm for them. So, where would you trace both of those qualities to? I mean, how did he become such a tiger nut to begin with?
Well, he studied anthropology rather than zoology.
Mm.
And, as it explains in the film, rather serendipitously, he took a journey to Ranthambore after his marriage broke up in 1976. And he was associated with making films. And once he got to Ranthambore, which is was a completely different place in 1976 as it is today, it was quiet, it was remote, very few people visited it. And it transformed him into this wonderful character prepared to spend time studying the Tigers of Ranthambore in the mid-1970s, when the Tigers were terrified of humans. They just got over eons of being hunted. But that was the origin of Valmik's love for the Tigers. He literally got on a train one day in Delhi after his marriage broke up and traveled to Ranthambore, and he never looked back. He spent the next 50 years visiting Ranthambore, and he had a home in Ranthambore many, many times, and developed a true love, a true passion for the tiger. Like, I've met a lot of tiger experts, but his was different from everybody else's. It was totally undiluted. It was total passion. It was total save the tigers at any cost. He'd take no prisoners if there are any excuses for the tigers going through rough times. And he was singularly important in saving the tigers from those early days when they started recovering from eons of hunting to today, when the tigers, particularly in Ranthambore, are doing better than ever before.
And some of that, Mike, I guess, goes with, because among the things that seem to distinguish him, not only his great knowledge and enthusiasm, as you've kind of outlined here, but he would go further than I think most people that might have similar passion for animals that were especially under siege. Like, can you talk a little bit about his public service efforts and sort of political involvement, which seemed to be a critical factor as well?
Yeah, he didn't shy away from getting involved in the politics. I made several films with Valmik that were all about the politics of saving tigers. And he was on the government committees, numerous committees in India about saving the tigers. I mean, the tigers in India are as important as the Taj Mahal. And it reaches the very top of the politics and politicians' agenda if anything happens to the tigers. But the amazing thing about Valmik, he had parents that were renowned politicians, renowned communists, funnily enough, in an Indian way rather than in a way US or UK may understand, but they were heavily involved in politics. So Valmik was brought up with understanding politics, not being frightened of politicians. And when I've traveled with Valmik in India, it's not unusual to sit down and dine or drink with the Nehru's or Gandhi family. He knew all the right people, and he used that to his advantage to convince the politicians in what needed to be done.
Yeah, it seemed like because maybe of his exposure from his family, he was not only comfortable, but he saw that that was a true mechanism to get his point across and get greater protections for the Tigers through those kinds of political efforts.
Yeah, and he wasn't afraid to make enemies. He was absolutely unafraid of...
Can you give us an example of that? That's always intriguing when someone's so passionate about what they're doing that they don't... That's not a concern.
Well, the governmental organization developed by Indira Gandhi was called Project Tiger, set up in the early 1970s. And it's a political organization, and it's had many heads, many top people. Some of them have been fantastic, and some of them have been outright terrible, absolutely terrible. And Valmik had no qualms about pointing this out. And I found that refreshing. And that's why I made a film with him in the early 90s called Tiger Crisis, when we started tackling these issues. Because in the early years, Project Tiger was seen as a savior for the Tigers. Because in the early 1970s, the reason Project Tiger was set up was they did a census of the Tigers and worked out there were probably fewer than 1,800 Tigers left in the whole of India. Whereas it was well known that at the turn of the last century, there were thought to be, I don't know how they knew this, but there were thought to be as many as 100,000 Tigers.
Wow.
A terrible decline from terrible hunting by the British and subsequently the Maharajas. But when Project Tiger was set up in the early 70s and to the mid 80s, it was thought of unreservedly as a brilliant tool to help save the tiger, because they set up initially 9 tiger reserves. It increased subsequently to a lot more than that, but 9 tiger reserves exclusively for the protection of tigers. And it was during that period from the early 70s to the mid to late 80s that Valmik got to know the tigers of Ranthambore really well. But towards the end of the 80s, things started going very wrong. And that was when Valmik had to change his modus operandi from someone who loved just spending time in the forest watching these beautiful tigers that had transformed from terrified nocturnal cats to really happy diurnal cats that were not afraid of people anymore. And he enjoyed that beautiful period. But then towards the 80s, end of the 80s, things started to go dramatically wrong.
And how so, Mike?
So I can only tell you from my point of view. So in the early 90s, I went to India for the first time, and I was making a David Attenborough narrated film called The Tale of the Peacock. And the BBC, in their wisdom, and I think with a little bit of... see what you can do here, Mike. They said, we'll take your film, because I'm an independent producer. I'm not employed by anybody. And they said, Mike, we'll take your film, The Tale of the Peacock, nice, funny title, but we want it as The Tale of the Peacock and the Tiger. Hmm. And I thought, oh, that's about as difficult as it gets, because going through the BBC archive, there was virtually no wild tiger footage. People had hardly ever filmed wild tigers because they'd been slaughtered for centuries.
So they just weren't, weren't around even to be shot on film because they'd been just wiped out so thoroughly?
Absolutely.
They're impossible to come across in the wild?
And they were nocturnal. The few tigers that existed in each of these 9 reserves in the early days only came out at night because they were terrified of humans.
They flipped their natural clock as one of the responses to being so terrified by all the poaching and hunting.
Yeah, a very clever tactic, which a lot of animals adopt.
Yeah,
in our country and probably in America, to adopt conflict with humans. They only come out at night.
Yeah.
But that changed in the 80s, early 80s, so much so that when I went to India, I'd done a lot of research, of course, to try and find out where I might see tigers. And the best books were written by Valmik and photographed by Valmik and a colleague of his called Fateh Singh Rathore. And they showed wonderful tiger encounters in the lakes of Ranthambore. So I thought, I've got to go there. It was close to the place where I wanted to film peacocks, Sariska, but that hadn't got very many observable tigers. And I went there. I didn't know Valmik at all. I'd only read his books, and I was looking for peacocks, and I had a peacock expert with me and a guide. And when I got to India, we went to Sariska. I found my peacock destination, perfect, no tigers. Then my guide said, for tigers, you need to go to Ranthambore and see what we've seen. I didn't know what he meant by we then, but this guy, our driver, was actually Valmik's brother-in-law, Tejbir Singh. And Tejbir, this was a total coincidence, but Tejbir and Valmik had filmed these tigers as they got used to becoming more diurnal. And Tejbir said, oh, he's incredibly modest, Tejbir. But funnily enough, another politician, he was the editor of Seminar, keeping this all in the Thapa family, a very highly recognized political journal, but he also loved wildlife. But he very modestly said, Mike, you should meet Valmik. And I think he's got the footage we shot in the mid-80s, because I was there in the early 90s. And I said, OK, I will when I get back to Delhi. He said, you also need to meet the director of the national park, Fateh Singh Rathore. Everybody knows him as the ultimate tiger waller, the tiger guru. Mm. He managed Ranthambore when it was a hunting reserve and very happily saw it transition from a hunting reserve into a glorious tiger park. Anyway, I went to meet Fateh Singh Rathore, and one evening I was sitting on his veranda having a gin and tonic, I should imagine, I can't remember, and his radio crackled into life. And I could tell he was very anxious. He's talking in Indian, but I could tell he was very, very anxious. And he said, Mike, I've got to go. Two people have just been shot by tiger poachers. Mm. And that was the moment it changed for me. And I realized that tigers were being killed and there was a war to save them going on, led by Fateh Singh Rathore at the time. And that was the moment it changed for me. And I had to ditch the film for the time being on peacocks and made this film Tiger Crisis. And it was during the making of the film Tiger Crisis that I met and interviewed Valmik. He was a big star of that film because of his passion. And
I would think he'd be the big star of almost any film that he happened to appear in, just based on what little I know about the guy. He just seems like such a presence and such an exuberant force. It'd be hard not to jump off the screen, no matter what film it is.
Yeah, well, that was very true. So I did that film, Tiger Crisis, and I think we made a huge difference to the survival of tigers. The director of Project Tiger was sacked as a result, and tigers slowly began to make a recovery. But you're right, Valmik's charisma shone through. And I presented to the BBC then a six-part series called Land of the Tiger. And I said Valmik would be a perfect presenter. And it was shown on PBS. And I think it was a big success, mainly because of Valmik's charisma and undiluted passion.
Well, let me let folks know, you might just be tuning in a little bit late. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, we're marking Earth Day in a distinctive manner. I'm speaking with my guest, Mike Burkhead, who served as co-director, co-producer, and co-writer of Legendary Tigers of India, a new episode of the long-running PBS series Nature, premiering tonight, April 22nd, marking Earth Day. This talk features the expertise and voices we're hearing from Valmik Tapur, one of the world's leading tiger experts, who told the story of this tiger dynasty for the first time in this film before passing away last year. If you'd like to ask Mike a question about tigers in India, about the doc, about Valmik, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Before we get into some more tiger talk, Mike, let me see if I can understand the chronology of how this film came together. So, to what extent did Legendary's Tigers of India exist before Valmik passed away, or was it only launched after he did pass away?
No, we concocted the idea in 2023. And Valmik kept in touch because I've known him for 30 years. And he's always, he had a passion for wanting to be on TV too. He was very passionate about broadcasting. I can't remember how many films, 10 films with Valmik. And he always used to keep me up to speed on the latest developments. And I think Valmik sadly knew he was coming to the end of his time. Mm. And he wanted to make one final film. And we knew this was a good time to do it. So we met up for his 70th birthday in a lovely house in the British countryside with several good friends and concocted the idea there. And then I had to sell it to the BBC, and then I had to sell it to PBS to make it. But yeah, jointly we put it together, and Valmik wanted to tell a story that reflected his passion for the Tigers of Ranthambore over the 50 years he'd been there.
Yeah. Let me see if we can take a call. Looks like there's a call that might want to get involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Mike Burkhead.
Hey, thank you. Your show always brings us people who are worldwide heroes for those that cannot sufficiently fight back against the human machine. I wanted to ask something. I've been thinking of, for years, of joining the anti-poacher patrols in Africa. And I'm ex-military, and, you know, I have no problem eliminating poachers. In fact, I would enjoy it. So I wanted to know what you think about that as far as the cultural aspects. Are you know, white Americans being racist or culture vultures or otherwise colonialist to go to these countries to shoot their indigenous, well, the people of those countries who are poachers? I actually, you know, think it's just like joining the Ukraine Foreign Legion to eliminate Putin's people. But what do you think about this?
All right, thanks for your call, Mike. Respond however you'd like.
India is very proud of its independence and doesn't take kindly to foreign interference. I'll give you one example. They're very proud, and rightly so, of they want to do it their way. Whether it's the right way or not, they want to do it their way, which is interesting. And a lot of people have donated money rather than what that gentleman was suggesting. And I remember once going to talk to the head of Ranthambore National Park, a really wonderful man called G.V. Reddy. And he said, money's not the issue. And he opened his desk drawer and said, I've got a check here for £60,000. Or dollars, I can't remember which. He said, and I just don't know what to do with it. We don't need it. We don't need help from overseas. This was from the official at the national park. So India wants to do it their way, and at the moment they're doing it really well. They have been through ups and downs, but they're very efficient and very good at what they do now. But they're just as independent as the UK or US, and they certainly have very few overseas researchers. There was one famous one from America called George Schaller, who wrote The Deer and the Tiger in mid-1960s. But it's not like a lot of other countries. They just don't advertise for overseas people or expertise. They're very happy with their own expertise.
And it sounds like not only do they not advertise for that, it sounds like they're really not open to outside, even if people are well-intentioned, it just sounds like that's not something they welcome.
Yeah, I think they think we're independent. We were controlled by various people for a long time.
We'll do it our way.
Do it our way, and you know, yeah. Credit to them for wanting to do that. They don't like it. Certainly, Britain doesn't always get it right. We could do with help sometimes. But yeah, India's proudly independent.
So one thing, Mike, we were kind of going over a little bit before the caller joined us, is how the film came together. So I just making sure. So this was something initially that you and Valmik were going to collaborate on, and then he got ill, I guess, and then at a certain point passed away. So did you sort of pick up the film from where it was, or had it begun when he was still alive, and then you had to kind of mutate into something else because he passed away? Or I'm just trying to make sure I understand the chronology.
No, we finished the film when he was still alive.
Ah, okay.
He died shortly. He did see it, which was good.
That's great.
No, he did. You know, it's almost like it was written in the stars that he did see the film. He was very happy with it. It was being shown in the UK and various other places last year. And yeah, I'm pleased he got to see it because, as you can tell from the end of the film, the way he phrases what he wanted to say at the end of the film, there was a sense he knew what was coming.
Yeah, and it's also, it seems like, part film about the Tigers and all the things that were important to him, but part film about Valmik himself. It's almost like a, you know, a profile of him and a profile of the Tigers sort of interwoven in a way.
Very much so. That's what I wanted to do, was to... You don't have to try hard to get Valmik front of any film because his passion shines through.
Yeah.
But the last 5 minutes, 10 minutes of the film, I did another film where a colleague of mine made a behind-the-scenes film. I don't know what PBS do with that, which is my tribute to Valmik. It's a 8-minute film, and my tribute to Valmik is not only as a colleague but as a friend. And I think PBS put it out on... But I'm not sure if they do. In Britain, it went out alongside the film. So very much during the making of the film, I got to realise Valmik sensed something was going to happen. But he wasn't ill during the making of it. It came on shortly afterwards.
So he just had a sense that his time may be coming to an end, even though he wasn't diagnosed, it sounds like, with anything at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he definitely did have a sense. I mean, the last 5 minutes of the film in particular makes it very clear that he had a sense that his time was coming. So, you know, sadly, it's always a terrible surprise, but he definitely had got what he wanted done. He wrote a lot of books too, and he sent me his last book, and that too made it very clear he knew the end was coming. So I think he tidied up what he needed to tidy up.
Yeah, I'm glad this film was completed and he got to see it. It wasn't clear to me if the chronology would have allowed that, but that's great that he saw this and he probably loved it
before. Yeah, I think it did a good job for Valmik. It showed his beloved Tigers. And it was a good legacy film for Valmik. And a lot of people have said that have seen the film.
Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Mike Burkhead, co-director, co-producer, co-writer of Legendary Tigers of India, a new episode of the long-running PBS series Nature, premiering tonight, April 22nd, noting that it's Earth Day. You're invited to join the conversation. Please call 813-239-9663. Email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. So as always, Mike, since most people haven't had a chance to see the film, I want to be careful about spoilers. But can you outline kind of just the rising and falling fortunes from a tiger's perspective of Ranthambore's National Park?
Yeah, well, Ranthambore has been a roller coaster ride that in many ways, it's one of, I can't remember the term, something like 50 tiger reserves now, exclusive tiger reserves in India. But what happens in Ranthambore is a mirror on what's happening elsewhere. It's incredibly well visited by tourists, to say the least. I mean, people like me are to blame for that because they watch the films and then they think they can see tigers, which they can in Ranthambore. So what we did was we tried to depict in this film the roller coaster ride of tiger numbers. And as I said, the 70s was basically a period where the tigers were recovering from eons of slaughter. And the 80s...
And was that because of the legislation that had been put in place, or What accounted for that rebounding of those numbers?
Yeah, directly. They suddenly stopped hunting. The biggest thing was they stopped hunting, which is incredible. One day, Indira Gandhi, the president, said, no more hunting. And hunting in India is virtually non-existent. Poachers have old blunderbusses and things, but guns aren't high profile. But they find other ways to kill tigers. But yeah, the tigers recovered without a doubt from the protection they received and stopping hunting. I mean, as we point out in the film, one Maharaja killed 1,300 tigers himself, shot 1,300 tigers.
Yeah.
So the numbers are staggering. So the 70s, as we portray in the film, was a period when the tigers literally started peeking out of the long grass and going, can we come out now? Can we come out? Is it safe? And the 80s, they went, yes, it is safe. We can come out and we're having a wonderful time. And that's shown in the footage that Valmik and Tejbir shot in the 1980s of the tigers hunting their prey in these lakes. Ranthambore is a Disneyland setting. It is surrounded by a huge Mughal fort, an ancient fort with incredible battlements. And below it, there are three crocodile-filled lakes full of prey for the tigers. It's a glorious setting. But the trouble was, in the 80s, Valmik's books in particular depicted these tigers as just like glorified pets. They were approachable, they were visible, and then they were taken advantage of by poachers who shot them at point-blank range or trapped them and then shot them for skins and bones to be sent to the east.
Because, again, at that point, the tigers weren't fearful of approaching people because they had gotten acclimated to them, not realizing they were about to be shot right squarely in the head, I guess.
Exactly. And Valmik makes a very sad point about that in the film. Yeah. And he feels very guilty for making the tigers so trusting. But no one expected it. But as I said, when I turned up in the early 90s, no one knew there was a crisis. And then we found out hundreds of tigers had been poached by organized gangs from a criminal in Delhi, the notorious criminal Sansar Chand had been organizing local people to kill tigers, paying them pounds, exporting them through Nepal and onto China for thousands of pounds. And that decimated the tiger numbers across India. But eventually they recovered, which is amazing that they did, because the bureaucrats woke up to this tragedy. And then, believe it or not, it all happened again. And it all happened again after we made several very happy films about tiger behavior in Ranthambore, followed one of the stars of the show called Matchley and all her progeny. But then all the tigers were slaughtered again in 2024 in one neighboring national park called Sariska.
And why did that happen, Mike? Well, I mean, why, when everything had been going along and all that had been sort of put behind everybody, why did this come along and lead to a big massacre like that?
Very similar. Once again, the demand from... It was slightly different. There was a slightly nuanced suggestion about, rather than just exporting skin and bones to China, there was a suggestion that Tibet became increasingly wealthy through harvesting a fungus that they could sell for thousands of pounds. And suddenly people had a lot of money to request tiger bones. And we intercepted a skin trafficking lorry that had thousands of leopards and hundreds of tiger skins on it.
Oh, geez.
And yet again, there was another terrible disaster took place. But it was a very peculiar instance, because Valmik and we were always fighting the authorities who wanted to deny there was an issue. And the reason they could deny there was an issue, the way they counted tigers was a very poor method of censusing. They used to count the footprints of the tigers in the sand and they thought they could recognize individual tigers, which they can't, as proved by a famous Indian scientist called Ulas Kiranth, who categorically disproved this. But Project Tiger continued to use this method, and little did they know this was very advantageous for them, because even if there was only one set of tiger footprints, the authorities would say there were 20 tigers, because they pretended that was that footprint was the footprint of 20 different tigers. But then, very bizarrely, one tiger reserve neighbouring Ranthambore called Sariska, every single tiger got killed. So all of a sudden, there were no tiger footprints, and there was no way they could spin a yarn about the tigers still doing well. And that exposed the second tiger crisis in 2004 and 2005. And I made a film with Valmik and Sir David Attenborough called Battle to Save the Tiger that illustrated what went on in that time period. And that's when Valmik became incredibly political. He was heading a government committee. He was challenging all the officials at Project Tiger. And he transformed things, and he's probably transformed things forever at that moment, because ever since then, bar a few small incidents, the tigers have just gone on to recover. And now there are 70 tigers at Ranthambore, and as I said, that reflects what's going on in a lot of other tiger reserves around India.
So this ties into a question that came in from one of our listeners by email asking what your estimate would be of tigers still alive. I think he's actually asking worldwide, but if you want to just tackle India, and if you can tackle a larger scale, that's great too. But I think he's just looking for a current number of tigers.
Yeah, well, tigers occur. I've made films on tigers in Russia, Sumatra, Nepal, and India, which is basically where they exist. There's maybe a few in Malaysia, and that's the only other place where they exist. And India probably, who knows, even though they've stopped the pugmark, footmark method of estimating tiger numbers, they now use camera traps, and they now use AI to identify the tiger stripes. So it's much harder to lie about tiger numbers. And there's probably around 3,000 tigers in India, easily more than anywhere else in the world. Sumatra probably has a few hundred. Nepal has probably a few hundred. And Russia, again, likewise, less than 500, but a few hundred.
Wow. So the numbers are low, have really dropped consistently over the years.
Although, still,
we rebounded it once or twice in India, it sounds like, based on what you're saying and what the film says.
Yeah, if anyone's thinking of going to see tigers now, this is as good a time as ever. But the one thing they should be prepared for is just how busy it is.
Because everybody else is there doing the same thing, you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. And but it's really exceptional at the moment. There were, towards the end of our film, which it features in the film, there were two of our females had each got three cubs, and they were around the main area of Ranthambore. But I'll give you one little anecdote about how things have changed. Mostly when I started going, there'd be a few Europeans there and very few Indians, local people going to see the tigers in the reserves. Nowadays, it's far more local people, Indians, going to watch the tigers than foreigners. The rise of local interest has been phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal, which is really good. That's the way it should be.
For sure. And do you point to films and other things as being the chief cause of that rising interest again, or... I mean, sometimes it sounds like some of these things have been cyclical, at least in India.
Yeah, I can't deny it. I often say to colleagues, we're to blame for when you so many people going. I mean, people will watch our film tonight, and people that are passionate about tigers may go, oh, I want to go and see those tigers. And they should, but the one thing they should brace themselves for, it's very busy. And I was just about to tell you one anecdote that what the Indians have done, which is a telltale sign of where we are nowadays. The Indian authorities have just banned, I don't know whether this has happened or is about to happen, but they've just banned people taking mobile phones into Ranthambore.
Oh, wow.
Because that is going to take some seeing too, because all these people want to have a selfie with a tiger, which is a crazy thing to say because they put themselves at risk leaning out of their vehicle to try and get a picture. But I mean, in the times I was filming there, mostly with my colleagues and cameramen, you could literally have a tiger outside your open Jeep door. And the tigers, rather like the Indian people themselves, are very gentle. And there's been very few incidents of man-eating tigers in India. There have been a few, but not many. Considering Ranthambore has 1 million people pilgrimage through the park itself, every year.
Wow.
To go to the temples. The temples take priority in India. And the reason India has maintained its megafauna, unlike most other countries, it's got elephants, crocodiles, gaur, tigers, it's even got lions, leopards. Despite having nearly 1.5 billion people, it's managed to preserve its wildlife. And that's because of its ancient religious beliefs. And it reveres wildlife, completely reveres wildlife.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. And it's sort of nearing the end of our time here, Mike, but anything about, you mentioned briefly Matchley, any other tigers in particular you want to mention that are featured in the film or otherwise?
Well, there are 5 females that we feature. Padmini was the first one that Valmik fell in love with. And of course, remember, she was very secretive and she was one of the first tigresses to reveal herself. And Valmik followed her for a number of years. Then there was one particular male which we feature called Genghis. Wonderful name. Gives you an idea of what Genghis was like. And he's the phenomenal male that developed a knack for charging into the Ranthambore's lakes and killing their prey in the lakes. And we show those unique sequences. And the latest female is Arrowhead. And as always, these tigresses have a unique relationship with their mothers because they always usurp their mothers from their territory. And that's one of the main themes of the films, is that the 5 matriarchs that we follow, each of them usurp their mothers from their territory and had to fight their mothers to have their own exclusive patch. And then their mothers had to go off and find another area.
Yeah, as I recall, Arrowhead was particularly a brave and bold hunter and like bounding into the water with the turtle there, but also, you know, full of crocodiles. It seemed unfazed at one point, eating a crocodile. So you couldn't scare Arrowhead, I guess, under any circumstance.
She must have inherited that from her mum, because we also show in one of our films and this film how Matchley caught and devoured a 14-foot-long huge crocodile, or mugger, that they call. And it's quite unbelievable to see the strength. And the female tigers are about 250, 300 pounds. Males are about 550 pounds. So the fact that Matchley and Arrowhead can take on crocodiles, mind you, Arrowhead had a very close call, as you can see in the film. Probably got a bit too blasé about tiptoeing into the lakes.
Yeah.
And nearly paid the ultimate price.
But I think we're giving a sense of the kind of stories and footage and exciting scenes and more that are part of the film that's, again, Legendary Tigers of India, that's premiering tonight on PBS, on the Nature Series PBS. And it's, I think, 8 o'clock p.m. most stations, most areas, 7 central. And we've been speaking with Mike Burkhead, who, again, co-writer, co-director, co-producer of the film. Mike, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals and making the time to speak with us about all these wonderful creatures, including Valmik.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you. Coming up a little bit later, we'll hear an Earth Day song, Mother Nature by Greg Roy, one of the extraordinary artists performing a tropical heat wave. There's one night festival that's happening this Saturday, April 25th. And again, the Cuban Club alongside Cracker, Elon and Jewel have done well travel and several other great bands. Tickets and info at WNF.org. Right now, we're going to step into the comedy corner with longtime fave Jim Gaffigan and his piece called Animal Lover in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WNF.
Part of a cow, and I love animals, and I love animal lovers. My favorite are the people that carry around the dog in a bag. Whenever I see that, I always think, what an adorable way to let us know you're crazy. Because they're crazy. They're carrying around an animal that can walk in a bag. They're not going to the vet, they're shopping. That's okay, but if I carry around a canned ham, I'm a weirdo. It'd be one thing if the dog looked happy, but the dog always has a look on his face like, can you believe I'm sitting in a purse? I was part of Mexican royalty. But I get it. I love dogs, and I think it's cute when people dress their dogs up. But how do you have your dog in a jacket and walk by a homeless person? Sorry, I'd help, but I spent all my money on a coat for my animal that's born with a coat. I love cats. Some people don't like cats. Our neighbor has a cat, and she lives in a studio apartment, or as I refer to it, a litter box. One time she asked me, she was like, can you even tell I have a cat? And I was like, no, but I can tell you have a box of turds in your apartment. I'm not sure if that's the same question. We all have the friend with the cat, right? In the small place, you visit them, the cat does their business. You don't really acknowledge it. You just go on with the conversation. What do you want on your pizza? Bleach. Febreze. Can we open a window or knock down a wall? Are my eyes bleeding? How about we throw a diaper on the kitty? But I get it, because I love animals. I think being around animals, there's a healing quality. But I also think we give animals too much credit. Like a dog is man's best friend. I've never seen a dog help someone move. Yes, horses are graceful and elegant until you see them poop standing up. Dolphins are smart. Learn English like Jesus did. For the record, I would never eat a dolphin because I don't like fish. And I know I'll get tweets where people will say dolphins are mammals, and those are the people I block. Because that's how I deal with criticism.
That was Jim Gaffigan in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Animal Lover, taken from his album Cinco. And shortly we're going to hear the Promised Earth Day song by Greg Roy, one of the 10 terrific artists performing at Tropical Heatwave WNF's One Night Festival this Saturday, April 25th at the Cuban Club. Cracker, Elon Jewel, Have Gun Will Travel, and several more bands. 10, count them, 10. Tickets and information are at WNF.org. So let's get to that Earth Day song right now. It's from one of those performing at Tropical Heatwave. This is Greg Roy with Mother Nature on Talking Animals on WNF.
Got to do all business. Got to protect Mother Nature. Got to protect Mother Nature. Yes. The world is in a crisis, so we got to do our bit. Yeah. Them spreading poison above and underground. Now the population of animals and plants gone down. From melting ice caps in the polar seas to plastic oceans and overfished seas. The signs are clear, yeah. So much pollution everywhere, yeah. The signs are clear, yeah. Like fire burning down your highway, well. Got to protect Mother Nature.
Say that again.
Got to protect Mother Nature,
yeah. Yes.
The world is in a crisis, and we got to do our best, yes. Got to protect Mother Nature. To protect Mother Nature, yes. The world is in a crisis, so we got to do our bit, yeah. Now let's talk to the people with technological advances and vehicles. Will you steal it or you drive it or you fly? No, tell me you never seen a sign in the sky. Well, the sign is clear, yeah. So much pollution everywhere, yeah. Burning down your highway. Got to protect Mother Nature.
Say that again.
Got to protect Mother Nature.
Say yeah.
The world is in a crisis, and we got to do our best.
We got to do our best.
Got to protect Mother Nature.
Say that again.
Got to protect Mother Nature.
Yeah.
That was Greg Roy, one of the performers this Saturday at Tropical Heatwave, one of 10 performers. Again, get your tickets. It's all happening at the Cuban Club. Get your tickets at WMNF.org. Don't miss it. Great, great lineup again, including Cracker, Elon, Jewel, Have Gun, Will Travel, Greg Roy, who we just heard, and many more. So don't miss that. Coming up on WMNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Myra Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's a Scoop, WMNF's brief news recap. Then we shift back to music programming with Sam Vaughn, holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C, hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m. And it continues with a little more great music on that WMNF 88.5 after that. So we'll see you next Wednesday here on Talking Animals. Stay tuned for The Conversation. It's 88.5 WMNF Tampa. Thanks again.